Descent of Angels by Mitchell Scanlon. Read by Gareth Armstrong. Prelude. It begins on Caliban. It begins back before the Emperor came to our planet, before there was even the first talk of angels. Caliban was different then. We knew nothing of the Imperium and the Great Crusade. Terra was a myth. No, not even that. Terra was a myth of a ghost of a memory, brought to us by our long-dead forefathers. It was an ephemeral and half-forgotten thing, with no bearing on our lives. It was the time of old night. Warp storms had made it impossible to travel between the stars, and each human world was left to fend for itself. We had passed more than 5,000 years in isolation from the rest of humanity. 5,000 years. Can you imagine how long that is? Time enough for the people of Caliban to develop our own culture, our own ways, drawing from the patterns of the past, but separate from what had gone before. Free from the influence of Terra, our society had developed in a manner more in keeping with the world in which we lived. We had our own beliefs and customs, aye, even our own religions. There's precious little of it left now, of course. It was all swept away by the coming of the Emperor. It is amazing to me, but there are children born of Caliban today who have never even heard of the Watchers or ridden a mighty warhorse. They have never known what it is to hunt the great beasts. This is the sorrow of our lives. Over time, the old ways are forgotten. Naturally, those who came in the Emperor's wake claimed this was all to the good. We are making a new world, a better world, a world fit for the future. We are making a better world. It is always the way with conquerors. They don't say they have come to destroy your traditions. They don't talk about banishing the wisdoms of your grandfathers, turning the world upside down, or replacing your ancient beliefs with a strange new creed of their devising. No one willingly admits they want to undermine your society's foundations and kill its dreams. Instead, they talk about saving you from your ignorance. I suppose they think it sounds kinder that way. But the truth of it remains the same regardless. I am getting ahead of myself, though, for at this moment in Caliban's history, all these things were unknown to us. In time, the Emperor would descend from the heavens with his angels, and everything would change. The Great Crusade had not yet reached us. We were innocent of the wider galaxy. Caliban was the sum total of our experience, and we were content in our ignorance, unaware of the forces heading towards us, and how much they would transform our lives. In those days, Caliban was a world of forests. Except for a few places given over to settlement or agriculture, the entire planet was covered in primordial, shadow-haunted woodland. The forest defined our lives. Unless a man made his home in the mountains or lived near the coast, he could spend his entire life without once seeing an open horizon. Our planet was also the domain of monsters. The forests teemed with predators, not to mention all manner of other hazards. To use a word we didn't know then, a word taken from the lexicon of Imperial cartography, Caliban is a death world. There isn't much here that is not capable of killing a man, one way or another. Carnivorous animals, poisonous flowers, venomous insects, the creatures of this world only know one law, and that is, kill or be killed. Of all the dangers to human life, there was one class of creatures that was always viewed as being set apart from the rest. They were more fearsome and brutal than any other animal we knew. I am talking about the creatures we called the great beasts. Each great beast of Caliban was as different from its fellows as a sword is different from a lance. Each creature represented the only example of its kind, a species of one. Their diversity was extraordinary. An individual beast might appear to be modelled after a reptile, or a mammal, or an insect, or else combine the features of all of them taken together in chaotic collaboration. One might attack with tooth and claw, another with beak and tentacle, another using horns and hooves, while yet another might spit corrosive poison or bleed acid in place of blood. If they had one dominant feature, it was that every one of them appeared to be crafted directly from the stuff of nightmares. Allied to that, they each possessed qualities of size, strength, ferocity, and cunning that made them the match of any ordinary human hunter, no matter how well armed he might be. It would not be overstating the case to say that the great beasts ruled the forests. Many of the customs we developed on Caliban owed their origins to the beasts' presence. For humanity to survive, we had to be able to hold the beasts at bay. Accordingly, knightly orders were formed among the nobility to create warriors of exemplary skill and ability, armed to the highest standards, and trained to protect human society against the worst predations of these monsters. They were aided in this by the persistence of certain traditions in the making of weapons and armor. Most of the technology our distant ancestors brought with them to Caliban had been forgotten in our isolation, but the knowledge of how to repair and maintain pistols and explosive bolts, swords with motorized blades, and armor that boosted a warrior's strength and power had been preserved. Granted, they were relatively primitive versions, and they lacked the reliability of the more powerful models later brought to Caliban by the Imperials, but they were effective all the same. We had no motor vehicles, so the knights of Caliban rode to war on the back of destriers, enormous warhorses selectively bred over thousands of years from the equine bloodstock brought to our world by its first settlers. In due course, the knightly orders went on to build the great fortress monasteries that still serve as many of the major places of settlement in modern Caliban. Whenever one of the beasts began to prey on a settlement, the leader of the local nobility would declare a hunting quest against the creature. In response, knights and knight supplicant would come to the area from every land, seeking to prove themselves by killing the beast and completing the quest. This, then, was the pattern of life on Caliban for countless generations. We expected it to continue indefinitely. We thought our lives would follow the same well-trodden path as the lives of our fathers and grandfathers. We were wrong, of course. The universe had other plans for us. The Emperor was coming, but the first currents of change in our society were already at work long before his arrival. Sometime before the Emperor came to Caliban, a new knightly order had been founded among our people. It called itself simply the Order, and its members put forward the startling proposition that all men were created equal. Previously, it had been traditional for knights to be recruited strictly and solely from among the nobility, but the Order broke with accepted practice to recruit from all layers of society. So long as an individual could prove by his deeds and his character that he was worthy of knighthood, the Order did not care whether he was a noble or a commoner. It may seem a minor matter now, but the issue sparked no small amount of turmoil and controversy at the time. Traditionalist diehards among the more established orders regarded it as the thin end of a wedge that they thought would inevitably bring the whole edifice of our culture crashing down and leave us as easy prey for the great beasts. In one case, this issue even led to open warfare. A group, calling itself the Knights of the Crimson Chalice, attacked the Order's mountain fortress at Aldarook and laid siege to it. In what would later be seen as one of the defining moments of Caliban's pre-imperial history, the Knights of the Order sallied forth and counterattacked before the enemy had completed their siege lines. The resulting battle was decisive. The Knights of the Crimson Chalice were routed, and the survivors hunted down to the last man. With this victory, the future progress of the Order was guaranteed. Supplicants flocked to them from all walks of life, and within the space of barely a few decades, the Order had become one of the most powerful and well-regarded knightly groups on Caliban. This was only the beginning, however. Whatever subtle changes were brought to our society by the rise to prominence of the Order were as nothing compared to what would happen when the Lion came to Caliban. With the benefit of hindsight, we now know that Lion L. Johnson is one of the Primarchs, wrought in gene labs by the Emperor to lead the armies of his angels, but at the time, he was far more extraordinary to us. We were not an unsophisticated people, nor were we primitives. Imagine the effect, though, as word spread across our planet that a man had been found living wild like an animal in the deep forests of the Great North Wilds. His features handsome and beautiful beneath the matted hair and the mud caked to his body. No one knew who he was, and he spoke not a word of human language. He had survived for years, naked and unarmed, in the wilderness of the most dangerous region on Caliban, a place where even fully armored knights hesitated to venture unless as part of a larger group. Nor was it the end of the wonders associated with this strange figure. In light of the details of his discovery, the wild man came to be called Lion L. Johnson, meaning the lion, the son of the forest, in the old tongue of Caliban. Having been brought to human society, Johnson soon demonstrated a prodigious talent for learning. He quickly assimilated human ways, learning the habit of speech within a matter of days. From there, his rate of progress increased exponentially. Within a few short months, he was the equal in mind of our finest savants. A month later, he had exceeded their greatest achievements and left them trailing in his wake. He never spoke of his days in the forest, nor could he account for how he had come to be living there or where he had come from. But his powers of reason and intelligence seemed unaffected by his time in the wilderness. His intellectual capacity was matched only by his physical power. None could match his strength or prowess in combat, and he swiftly mastered the skills of knighthood to be accepted into the order. As might be expected, given his abilities, Johnson rapidly ascended through the order's ranks. His achievements were legendary, and coupled with a natural talent to inspire intense devotion in others, his presence soon led to a marked upsurge in recruitment. As the number of knights within the order increased, and new fortress monasteries were built to accommodate them, Johnson and his supporters started to press for a crusade to be mounted against the great beasts. Their proposal called for a systematic campaign to clear the beasts from the forests, region by region, until Caliban was finally free from their scourge. Objections were raised to the proposal, of course. The Order was the dominant military power on Caliban, but it was still only first among equals in the eyes of the other knightly orders. Given the size of the scheme Johnson had put forward, it would require the actions of every knightly order working in unison to a common plan to have any hope of succeeding. This was no small undertaking, considering that the knights of Caliban had always been inclined to feud and squabble amongst themselves. Combined with this, the plan would also need the support of the wider nobility and the common population. In general, though, we are not the kind to easily follow after leaders on Caliban. Each man has too high a regard for his own opinions. Then there were other problems. The faint-hearted said it would be impossible to truly clear the beasts from the forests. It was too grand a scheme, too much the product of hubris. Some viewed the great beasts with supernatural dread, believing that any plan of extermination would only awaken an apocalypse by uniting the beasts against humanity. Finally, there were concerns even among those who backed Johnson's aims. Some of them counseled caution. Johnson had envisioned a span of 6 years from the beginning of his war against the beasts to victory. But even his allies thought this was not enough time to achieve the plan's objectives. They feared he had failed to take full account of the human factor. He had forgotten that the plan would be carried out by individuals who did not share his own extraordinary mental and physical abilities. Johnson might be superhuman, but he was the only one of his kind on Caliban. His plan would not be carried out by supermen. The real hard work would be done by mortal men. In the end, Johnson carried the day. His supporters argued that the people of Caliban had skulked for too long behind the walls of their settlements. They had lived too much in fear of the beasts. Man was made to have dominion over the wilderness, they said, not vice versa. It was time to restore the world to balance, to end the reign of the beasts, and give mankind dominion over the forests. "This is our world," he said. "It is not the world of the beasts. It is time we took our stand." So the decision was made, and Johnson would have his campaign. One by one, the beasts were hunted down and killed. They were driven from the forests. They were tracked to their lairs and destroyed. In one thing at least, though, some of those who had opposed Johnson were proven right. For it took more than 6 years to finish the campaign. It took 10 years of constant campaigning, 10 years of hardship, 10 years of friends maimed and lost. But ultimately it was worth it. Our cause was just, and we achieved our ambition. 10 years, and not one of the great beasts remained. It occurs to me that I have been slapdash in one respect in telling this story, for I have made no mention of the one man who could hold forth knowledgeably on all the topics before us. I have talked of Caliban, of Lionel Johnson, and of the campaign against the great beasts. But I have neglected to mention the most important player in our drama. I am talking about Luther. He was the man who found Johnson in the forest and gave him his name, the man who brought him to civilization and taught him the ways of human society. He was the one who, through all Johnson's exploits and honors, stood side by side with him and matched him. Luther had not Johnson's advantages in matters of war and strategy. He was born a man, after all, not created to be more than human. Yet as Johnson's actions began to change the face of Caliban, Luther kept stride with him, equaling the wild man's accomplishments with his own. Too often, the Imperium portrays Luther as the devil. Some say he grew jealous of the lion, for though the two of them had shared in many victories, it was always Johnson who was lauded for these triumphs. Others say Luther grew increasingly bitter at being so much in the lion's shadow. They say a secret seed of anger was born in Luther's heart in those days, the seed of future hatreds. But those who repeat such things are liars. Luther always loved Johnson like a brother. I know Luther well, and you may be assured I am well placed to comment on his secrets. Luther is the key to understanding so much of how our world came to be where it is today. But it is better if we do not speak too much of Luther now. It will only work to the detriment of my story. To begin a tale with too many secrets tends to cause confusion. After all, in my experience, it's always better if you build towards these things more slowly. Poor, poor Luther. We will get to him in time, you may be certain of that point. We will get to it all in time. I will account for everything in time. For now, though, the stage of my story is set. It is the 10th year of Johnson's campaign against the great beasts. Nearly all the beasts have been killed, and only a few stragglers remain in the less hospitable and more thinly populated regions of the planet. Once the last of the great beasts are gone, we will all be able to build new lives. We can found new settlements, we can clear the trees for fuel and lumber, and plant new fields. For the first time, we will have control over our existence in ways we never had before. A golden age beckons our people. It is before the Emperor came to our planet, and before the time of angels. But the old ways are already dying. The world of our childhood will not be the world of our future. Many are unhappy at the prospect, but it is entirely possible that the world we inhabit tomorrow will be like nothing we could have foreseen. Change can bring out the worst and best in us, or something of both qualities at the same time. Some look at the horizon and fear the future, while others look and see it shining in welcome. It is the 10th year of Johnson's campaign, and the world turns beneath our feet. Unknowing, we stand on the brink of a bright new age of progress. We stand on the brink of learning of the Emperor, of the Imperium. We stand on the brink of becoming angels. But as yet, we know nothing of these things. On Caliban, it is a time of innocence. But already the storm clouds gather. It is said that a man should be wary of weeping angels, for wherever their teardrops fall, men drown. This is the shape of our lives. These are the days that made us, that formed our conflicts and decided our future. This is a time of which much will be written, but little understood. The histories created by those who follow after us will be riddled with falsehoods and fabrications. They will not know why we turned from the lion. They will know nothing of our motives, but you can know them. You can know it all. Come, listen, and you will hear my secrets. Come, listen, and we will talk of Luther and Lionel Johnson. We will talk of schism and civil war. We will give voices to the dead. Come, listen, hear my secrets. Let us talk of the dark angels and the beginnings of their fall.